As we continue on along in this little sermon series on Romans 12, today we focus on verse 14, in which we are encouraged to bless those who persecute you, bless, and do not curse them. And I've struggled this week about what to say because I know that Paul was writing to a group of new Christians who were experiencing persecution, that is, imprisonment and death, because of their faith, and that situation doesn't really translate to ours. I would venture to say that Christians in the United States of America do not experience religious persecution, although people of other religions in our country do experience, if not persecution, some pretty strong prejudice or hate. Christians in other parts of the world are persecuted, and by that I mean they are killed because they are Christians. It's complicated. In the United States, there are hate crimes committed against those of other faiths. Perhaps most common are hate crimes against Muslims. Mosques are graffitied or burned, Muslims are threatened, hurt, or killed. And we decry that. We say that is wrong. But then if we read about the persecution of Christians in other countries, in other parts of the world, often it occurs in predominantly Muslim countries carried out by extremists. That strengthens the resolve of those in our own country who persecute American Muslims. But I would say that radical Islamic terrorists do not represent the heart of Islam. Just as I would say that white supremacists and the Ku Klux Klan, which claims to be a Christian organization, do not represent the heart of Christianity. Because at the heart of Christianity lies something other than vengeance and hate. Jesus was not hateful. He did not seek revenge on Judas who betrayed him, on the soldiers who arrested him, on the religious and state authorities who sentenced him to death. As he died, he did not call down the legions of angels to save him and get the bad guys. What he said was, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." That's echoed in the words of Paul in verse 14, "Bless those who persecute you, bless, and do not curse them." It makes no sense unless you fully immerse yourself not only in the teachings of Jesus, but also in the way of life that he calls us to. One of the interesting things about working with the letters of Paul is remembering that Paul actually wrote before the Gospels were written, although the Gospels tell a story that happened before Paul wrote his letters. I wonder if Paul heard stories of Jesus told out loud around a campfire or in a home. I wonder if he'd heard some version of the Beatitudes and that those words were in his head when he wrote this passage from Romans, because there's a lovely harmony between the Beatitudes and Romans 12. But Paul wrote in a very different context than the gospel writers. He was a devout Jew raised at the crossroads of world civilizations that drew from the great academic traditions of both the Greeks and the Romans. He had an experience of Jesus then that changed his life. He stopped persecuting Christians and began following Christ. So perhaps he knew of what he wrote when he urged the Romans to bless those who persecuted them. Perhaps he knew better than most how a blessing, a good word, a sincere praise could change hate into something else. In some ways, Paul's letter to the Romans, and especially this part of chapter 12, best represents his understanding of the new way of life Christ calls his followers to. In ways that are subtle, and really not subtle at all, Paul took on the way of life prescribed by the superpower of Rome. Now, I want you to go ahead and picture in your mind's eye some fabulous Cecil B. DeMille Roman chariot movie, okay? I want you to get that image, the gladiators, the Colosseum, the soldiers in their army and their plumed helmety things. Because Caesar after Caesar after Caesar ruled by military might, the Pax Romana, the peace of Rome, was achieved through military victory. If someone stood in your way, well, you killed him. It was a violent world, and loyalty to Caesar was essential. Human Caesars were considered divine and worshipped, along with the pantheon of other Roman gods. And then the Christians came along. They wouldn't worship Caesar. They wouldn't call Caesar Lord because Jesus Christ was their Lord. The authorities of Rome claimed that the Christians practiced abominations, that they were mischievous and superstitious. They thought the Lord's Supper sounded an awful lot like cannibalism. They thought that Christians, in renouncing the ways of the world, actually hated the human race. Political and religious, the politics and religions were so interwoven, and Christians were on the wrong side of both, as far as Rome was concerned. When there's something new that is different and weird, and you don't understand it, and you're the one in power, the first impulse can be to get rid of that thing. And so Rome practiced to varying degrees persecution of the Christians. Paul told those Christians, those followers of Jesus, that in response to the persecution, they were to bless those soldiers and those gladiators and those Caesars. Bless them, do not curse them. It makes no sense. It makes no sense. Unless you look at the whole of Jesus' message, which is that peace will not be achieved through physical violence or power, but through nonviolent justice. And that begins by seeing your enemy not as an enemy, but as a human being. As Paul says later in the passage, if your enemies are hungry, feed them. If your enemies are thirsty, give them something to drink. This thing about making peace by seeing your enemy as a human being and pursuing peace through nonviolent justice is that it takes a long time. There are no quick fixes. There are no easy victories. There's no sated bloodlust. There's no revenge or satisfaction that feels so good. It's more like one step forward and two steps back. And I think about the long and arduous work engaged by people in the world to overcome persecution. It was in South Africa where Mahatma Gandhi learned about nonviolent resistance as he was a man of color in a white-dominated society. He took that learning back to his native India, where he worked tirelessly using nonviolent means to help India gain independence from Britain and to establish a country that embraced religious pluralism. That part didn't happen, but Gandhi continued his work until he was assassinated for being too accommodating of those who opposed him. As the issue of apartheid came to a head in South Africa in the 1980s, it was the work of the church, of Bishop Desmond Tutu, and the calm in a storm leadership of Nelson Mandela that helped lead that country out of repressive racism. When apartheid was dismantled, the government began the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, very public confession of very real violence and sin, an effort to cauterize some of the wounds by opening them and exposing them to the power of healing. It's not perfect there yet, not by a long shot. There are still tensions and poverty and racism. But the thumb of oppression has been lifted, and the church, in part, is to thank. In Northern Ireland, the troubles between Protestants and Roman Catholics rumbled on for decades, creating a society of such sudden violence that no one felt safe. It was Christian against Christian, and although the conflict was political in nature. Only a few remembered this way of life that Jesus called them to. When the troubles ended in the late 1990s, it was more because of a weariness of all the violence and some key political concessions rather than a Gandhi-like leader who led them toward peace. But I still wonder what effect all the prayers had, the prayers of the Roman Catholics and the Protestants, the prayers of the priests and the nuns and the men and the women who were tired of losing their loved ones to violence. But then I think about how Coptic Christians in Egypt, or Orthodox Christians in Syria, or Christians staring down Boko Haram in Nigeria would hear these words. Do they live amid so much violence that they cannot imagine blessing their persecutors? Or do they hold fast to these words as the only real, holy solution? The natural disasters of this last month have been horrifying and depressing and sickening. And the silver lining has been the stories of good, the stories of neighbor helping neighbor, the stories of people going the extra mile for complete strangers, for people who in other circumstances they would see as an enemy or a persecutor. Jim Wallace of Sojourners Magazines tells one such story about the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey in Houston. He writes, "I read a story about a top mixed martial arts heavyweight fighter, Derek Lewis, who is black, rescuing a white couple in spite of the fact that the husband insisted on bringing his Confederate flag with him. The way Lewis tells it, I picked up one guy and his family, his wife. He just kept apologizing to me because all he really had was his clothes, and he wanted to take his Confederate flag, Lewis said. He wanted to take that with him, and he just apologized and said, man, I'll sit in the back of your truck, man. I don't want my flag inside your truck like this. And I said, man, I'm not worried about that. His wife kept hitting him. His wife kept hitting him and saying, you should have just left it. There are things we're going to have to leave behind if we're going to follow Jesus on this road to peace. We'll have to leave behind our desire for vengeance. We'll have to leave behind all the good curses we've been storing up. We'll have to leave behind our definition of what an enemy is. But who knows what we'll pick up along the way? A friend, perhaps, or some grace, or an insight that changes everything. Who knows? God knows. Amen.